This podcast is supported by BP.
We set up on borehole 106 today.
BP is working to bring more lower carbon energy to the UK, like hydrogen, and we're keeping oil and gas flowing from the North Sea.
Ready to head out?
Yeah, let's go.
It's and, not or. That's how BP is backing Britain. Whilst today we're mostly in oil and gas, we increased global annual investment into our lower carbon and other transition businesses from around 3% in 2019 to around 30% in 2022. bp.com/and, not or.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your multicolor rubber band ball of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. In through the nose, out through the mouth. In through the nose, out through the mouth. Are we healed? I certainly hope so, because if that is not the end goal of the new Andre 3000 album, then I gotta be honest, I don't know what it might be. Andre, one half of Outkast and one of the most important, gifted, and technically astute rappers of all time, has not released music, has not released solo music, really of any kind, apart from a few guest appearances here and there in the last 15 years. But if you have been following the internet chatter about Andre, one thing you know is that every now and again, someone captures him on video walking around somewhere playing a wind instrument, one of various types of flutes. And so New Blue Sun is this album that came out last week, and it is an album of experimental music. Andre plays flute or various wind instruments on it, and it's made with a kind of who's who of experimental musicians in Los Angeles. At the beginning, you were listening to a little bit of the opening track, and that's "I Swear I Really Wanted to Make a Rap Album," quote unquote rap album, but this is literally the way the wind blew me this time. There is some Andre wordplay here. It's just all in the song titles. And there is so much to talk about, both about the music and the technical aspects of this album, but also about what does it mean for an artist of Andre's caliber and an artist of Andre's success level to make an album of music designed to de-emphasize his celebrity and to de-emphasize his centrality. And so we're going to have two segments today on the show. First, we're going to talk to Zach Baron. Zach Baron works at GQ. He is the senior special projects editor there. Recently, he interviewed Andre for a feature profile and also for a video news magazine-y type story that you can see on YouTube. So we're going to talk to Zach about Andre, the anti-celebrity, Andre, the pensive person, and Andre, the star in retreat. And then we're going to talk about New Blue Sun. We're going to talk with Sadie Sartini Garner, who reviewed the album quite enthusiastically for Pitchfork. And we're going to talk to Sadie because Sadie is, so far, the only writer I've really seen who is attempting to locate this album, not in the context of Andre's prior work, which is part of the story, but in the context of the scene that has been bubbling around the musicians that he's chosen to work with on this project, and this scene, which has been long running and is musically diverse and experimental, and set out in the review to see this album as a product, not just of Andre, but of that universe. So first Zach, then Sadie, first celebrity, then music. Let's just get right into it. Zach Baron is here. Zach, my dear, how are you?
I'm great, man. I'm great.
As any person who had spent time in the laundromat with Andre 3000 would be, you've washed clothes with Andre 3000. You're never going to fail, is, I believe, how the song goes.
Yeah, that's exactly how the song goes. Yeah, I too have workwear overalls now, contemplating a new uniform. No, I was like, what is this brand called? And can I have some? And I got the name of the brand and I cannot have some.
From now on, they will have no choice but to call us the ants.
Yes. Yes. And when I asked him about that, which I don't think made the story, it's a very interesting story. Basically, ants will follow a leader anywhere, including until death. So Andre is very fascinated with the idea, and kind of the logo on the workwear ant circling a flute. And I was like, are these ants marching to their death? And he was like, no, the flute has intervened and saved their life.
Pied Piper?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically just like that.
Not to get too abstract about the ideology, but is he talking about ants in the sense of fans? And is he talking about the flute as a way of reorienting like the countless thousands and millions of people who are Andre/Outkast fans and reorienting them away from, I don't know, the death of oppressive fandom towards something more holistic and healing?
I think he's too pure and honest to be operating on that level, but perhaps self-consciously. And I think your description of what's happening is entirely accurate.
Although I think the question, it's an open question, whether the millions of people who love Outkast records wish to be reoriented away from Outkast. That to me is an open question.
I don't even think it's an open question. I think they'd probably prefer not to be.
Yeah, fair. We're here because Andre has put out a solo album of wind instrument music. Let's call it new age / experimental adjacent music. It's called New Blue Sun. It has a bunch of songs that are 12 to 15 minutes long. But I think part of what is on display in this album is it's not simply an album of music. It is an album of emotional positioning. It is a way of deliberately reorienting a narrative. And you being one of the few people to speak to Andre in this time window, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how he talked about that conscious, like tearing away the old narrative and pushing this new one. How much was he engaged with that in your conversation? Obviously, he's engaged with it in the work, but in your conversation, how much did he want to talk about that?
I think he knows that's the first and only conversation to be had. The first song on the record is called, what is it? I Swear I Want to Make a Rap Album, But This Is the Way the Wind Blew Me. I think I did that off memory. But so he knows that's what people want from him. And I think it honestly, and I don't want to play like psychologists and reporting is reporting. And so he never said this verbatim, but I think he's like somewhat tortured by it.
By the expectations, by the sort of persistence of the expectations.
Yeah, man, it is hard to have the psychological weight of literally millions of people wanting you to do something and you feeling like, for whatever reason, you either can't or don't want to do it.
And that's how I feel. That's how I feel every day. And it's really only just four or five people who want me to do something that I'm not doing.
That's right. Exactly. And I think one of the ways in which he's special is he can withstand that pressure. And in fact, I don't even know if he really contemplates caving into the pressure, but he understands that he's got to address it. And I do think this record, whether consciously or unconsciously, is a way to get out from underneath those expectations by just resetting the terms of the conversation. If he had done like any kind of rap or rap adjacent album, he would be in the middle of a conversation he doesn't want to be having, making work that he doesn't feel capable of making. So he had to go like pretty far afield, and this is where he landed. I think there's like an interesting question about if you really follow Andre, you know that he was working on something in 2015 and 2012 and 2019. Like, this isn't the first swerve or thing he's tried to make. It is the first thing that actually got released to the world.
And also, you have to put this in the broader context of what Andre did as a member of Outkast. So many of the things that rap fans find themselves, classicist rap fans find themselves up in arms about in the last 10 years, Outkast was doing 20 years ago. And perversely, almost doing it too early to be part of some kind of state of the genre conversation, because it making records like Speakerbox, The Love Below was so radically different than anything that was happening elsewhere in the genre, and certainly outside of the immediate Atlanta circles that they worked in, that you almost didn't have these hefty, oh no, like post Drake, the genre's changing. It's those guys. They were so signature. And Andre had a lot of freedom, particularly in those later records, that maybe even 5 to 10 years later, there would have been much more conversation about just how much freedom a rapper in a Southern group that's one of the most important groups in rap history should be allowed to have. Obviously, those conversations are BS, but they predated a lot of this stuff. And so it must be strange, I would imagine, for Andre to grow up and watch, in essence, a tiny bit of conservatism seep in, and then him feel like, hey, I do show up once every 2 years. I still can rap circle. Like, I can still eat any of y'all on any day if I choose, but I don't want to play. Tell me a little bit about, like, how he talked about his relationship to, like, the genre, like, and the conversations of the genre.
I think, obviously, insanely complicated question, because early Outkast, he even joked, it's in the name. Names kind of mean something, and we were literally called Outkast. And one of the things that he and I talked about, you can watch this on YouTube, they get booed at the Source Awards in what years at 95, moment. I believe. Yes.
Yeah, the South got something to say.
Yes, which is an iconic Andre moment. But on some level, this is a guy who's incredibly used to not being fully understood. And stylistically too, him dressing like a guy from outer space and doing all these sort of stylistics wars. Rap was not doing that when he was doing it. People who do it now are basically following in his footsteps. So he, like, on some level, it's like, it's just noise to him. He's completely used to people not getting what he's doing, people being oppositional to what he's doing.
Imagine being so far ahead of the curve fashion-wise that people give credit to Pharrell and Kanye and Tyler, the Creator, in essence, for things that you did 15 years prior and set the table for with affection to all those people. Just imagine.
Yes. And he's the guy that Tyler calls. He's still that guy to all of them, even if the rest of the world is, but where are the bars?
Do you think Tyler has a good collection of Benjamin Bixby pieces?
I think he's got some. Yeah.
I would love to. One of my big regrets of the big finale Barney's closeout sale was there was so much Benjamin Bixby.
I think you and I might have respectfully. Yeah, we went together.
Yeah. And I just didn't take any of it home. And I do regret it. I actually looked on eBay the other day. There's really not much floating around, unfortunately.
I honestly think that when all the dust settles, Benjamin Bixby will be yet another thing that Andre was like way ahead of the curve on, that everyone was like, I don't know, man. Are you sure? And then after the fact, everyone's like, God, can we get that back? Like, where is that?
If anybody has any XL Benjamin Bixby, hit me. If you have any mediums, it's that.
Look, yeah. Well, large in some sizing, medium in others, but yeah. Depending on the silhouette, of course.
Of course, obviously. It's crucial. You wore like a lightly oversized silhouette. I saw in the video a lightly oversized shirt silhouette.
That's right. Yeah,
I caught that. Okay, let's talk a tiny bit about Andre's disposition. Because the thing that really, and I've interviewed Andre a few times before. I've interviewed him as part of Outkast. I've interviewed him individually. I don't know that I've ever seen Andre as lucid and beatific in the same moment as in this video of the interview that you guys did. And I've spent time with him where he like talks quite a lot, like unconventionally, but did not seem totally comfortable. And then I've sometimes had moments where he seems really comfortable, but maybe isn't saying a whole lot or talking around the questions. I watched this video and I was like, this is a grown-up who like absolutely is in charge of what he's doing and is speaking the truth.
And was in front of one of our great interviewers of this generation. Don't forget about that part. No, I will take zero credit for that. I think you're absolutely right. In some ways, I think there's a Rick Rubin podcast he did a couple of years ago where he sounds anguished, where his relationship to making new work is the same as it is now, but not at all at peace with it. He's like, I try to rap and I can't, and it's driving me insane. You could tell that he was in a really bad place. But it's funny because Rick Rubin is like almost morphs into producer mode in the middle of a podcast.
How can I get this out of you?
Yeah. He's like, have you tried meditating? But I do think that making something to me felt a little bit like, okay, now I have a thing that I'm proud of that is real, that represents exactly where I'm at. And it felt like having that made him feel more comfortable. He's also just 48 and I think a little bit more sure of himself. Which honestly like gets back to something that you were saying. He was a boundary pusher in rapping in like a lot of ways. And one of the things I think is really interesting about, and we should be explicit about it. Andre is, I'd like to rap and I can't, right? That's like that's the first track of the record. It's like something that he and I talked about. It's this very strange thing. And when we talked, there was even a moment where he's, what am I going to rap about? I got to get a colonoscopy. And my reaction in the moment was like, yes. Isn't the whole thing that was cool about Andre as a rapper since like day one was that he would talk about stuff like that? And isn't like part of the cool thing about the way he expanded the genre through Outkast's work that rap theoretically can contain a conversation about, I got to get my eyesight checked. And if there was anybody who could realize those dreams and be like, this is what rap sounds like at 48, you really would have thought it would have been him. So in some respects, I do think this is puzzling. And when I asked him about it, he's, I don't even disagree with you. It's just like where I'm at is that I just can't do it. But I think by making this, he seems to have found some peace with it.
Yeah, I will say like that was the one part of the interview that was frustrating because obviously we all remember the Jay-Z 444 conversation of, oh, adults are rapping, you know, and it never totally liked the idea that like we weren't getting quote unquote adult seriousness to like how young people were rapping. And obviously so much of the most important rap music of all time is like premature adulthood on the shoulders of extremely young people. For lack of a better way of putting it, middle-aged life crisis type records. And people say, oh, Jay-Z did it. And yeah, Jay-Z did it, but Jay-Z's a billionaire. That's a particular stripe of that record or that life that is being communicated. Andre both has the capacity, I think, to tell a very different story about this time in a person's life and also do it stylistically in a way that we could not have anticipated. And the counter argument, of course, is he has done it stylistically in a way we couldn't have anticipated. It just genuinely has nothing to do with rapping, which is fine. But I was a little bummed to hear him, in essence, say that he did not think in this moment rapping as a medium and hip hop as a space could contain some of the complexity of what he's going through.
He compared it to boxing and he was like, boxing, older boxers fight exhibition fights, but they don't get in the ring. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to hear. He's a greater authority on this stuff than I am. And he was like, honestly, physically, you'd have to train for it. He's like, I'd have to go to the studio. I'd have to do all this stuff. And I'm not willing to. And again, it's not the answer I wanted, but it's an interesting answer. The other thought I had.
It's from someone who has done it at a very high level. Like, I think probably that was true when he was 19 or 23 or 26, that the work product that they put out was the product of that level of intense getting your reps in. I don't necessarily know that it always has to be that way, but like that's probably his mode.
It was funny. I was driving around today, actually listening to the record again, and I'm 41 myself and I live in Los Angeles. Thank you very much. Yep. We made it. And I was like, he's not wrong that I'm very curious about your take on this record because mine is, I think it's really good. And it reminds me of music I've heard when I was getting acupuncture. Now, had I gotten acupuncture in my life at 25? I had not. Had I gotten it at 30? I had not. Had I gotten it at 35? I had not. At 41 with a bad back and like a small child to pick up and put down a lot, I hear stuff in a different...
The life experience is embedded in the form.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm driving around LA, looking at the sun, feeling kind of existential with some pain in the body. And I'm like, I understand why he made this record. I really do. It probably is an authentic portrait of what it's like to be Andre 3000 at 48. Now, are there millions of people waiting for that record in the way that there are millions of people waiting for like literally any Andre verse, let alone Outkast song? Probably not. And that circles back to something I was saying before, which is I really admire an artist who's just like, I know you want something. I know you want it really badly and you're not going to get it. And also, let's not forget that there's like a financial, like he could be on stage tomorrow with adoring crowds of tens of thousands of people for millions and millions of dollars. All he would have to do is just say yes. And like a lot of people would work really hard and he could be on that stage like the next day. And every day he wakes up and he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that.
I wonder. Okay. So two things. One, I don't agree about the record. It feels like record made by a person or people who have nowhere to be.
Well, that's a very LA thing too.
I've only listened to it twice. like I'm mindful of, but maybe not terribly steeped in the universe of the music, the particular musicians that Andre worked with on this record. I have at various points listened to different Carlos Nino records. It's not necessarily like the thing that I get up and play in the house or in the car. You know, it's just, it's fine. It doesn't do it for me personally. But I also was trying to think of it in the context of, you know, I think a term I saw floating around was healing music, thinking about Laraji, thinking about new age music of the 1980s. And also to me, by those standards, it doesn't hold up. It doesn't feel as coherent. The textures don't feel as absorptive. It's ruminative, but does not find conclusions. And that's fine. Like, not all music has to do that. And my biases may be in the other direction, but I did not find it successful on either sets of those terms. Now, I do find it successful as, like I said, a weaponization of a certain aesthetic position, which is, I am this person now. And I think you said it quite well earlier. I'm this person now. Anything that follows can only follow because I ripped the mandate off and did this. And this is the point from which you have to assess me moving forward. And now that's also, respectfully, a multimillionaire talking. That's like a wealthy person saying that. It's not a popular way to think of it, but that's a wealthy person who's put out a album of wind instrument music that if any other human on the planet had put out, we would not be here talking about.
No, absolutely not. And also, he's really into Pharoah Sanders and Coltrane and Steve Reich. And I think he'd be the first to say, like, he is not as accomplished.
No.
As those musicians are.
I served with Laraji. You are no Laraji.
And the coolest thing about reporting this, honestly, was like he had his flute with him. He was playing his flute kind of like between video shots and stuff like that. And then we did get some of it on camera. We like went out to the alley and he played and it was awesome, man. It was like, it was legit awesome because while the accomplishment may not be there, and I think you're absolutely right that because of that, we would not be having this conversation. If he just dropped this anonymously on Spotify, it probably would be like, when you were getting like a massage at the Hawaiian resort or whatever, like this might come on and you'd be like, oh, this is like really emotionally deep. But I do think there is something about him as an artist that is like very pure and very effective and very like just like emotionally clear and transparent. And like when I was standing next to him and he was playing the flute, I was like, I am transported. I am moved. I'm like feeling things. And I think maybe I'm hearing the record partially with that in mind because I've seen the direct one-to-one. And he even talked about that, about how a cool thing about walking around with your flute, bad thing is people like film you and play like Where's Waldo and treat him even stranger than people already. Andre already gets treated like an alien and this just exacerbated that, but which he does not love. But he was like, the cool thing about this flute is like when I play it in line at Starbucks, I get to see like seven people like react in real time. And it's very funny when you have like Outkast catalog, like Hey Ya is playing at a wedding right now, but he's not at the wedding and he doesn't really want to get on the stage and play the song. But the one-to-one connection that he's like forging, wandering the earth with this flute and attempting to do so with this record is very cool for him. And honestly, like having been able to experience it like firsthand, like extremely cool for the rest of us too.
I will say like my main emotional takeaway, because it's you never arrive at a piece of music purely as music, especially in this context, you couldn't possibly arrive at it. You arrive at it seeking something, whether it's understanding of what led this individual to essentially go off grid more or less for 15 years. You want to find some musical bridge between the things that you loved as a younger person and the things that you might love now. You want to understand what it means to potentially retreat and to feel something like that. But my main point of enthusiasm for this record, which is, it's reserved, but it is real. If you think about Andre in 2000 and 99 and 96 and 94 and 04 or whatever, Andre taught generations of young people how to be free, truly taught them how to be free. And you see how this has paid dividends, especially within hip hop, for 20 years. This record, in its refusenik stance, is once again firmly a lesson in how to be free. And it doesn't have to achieve, to my mind, it doesn't have to achieve something musically so much as it achieves something in discipline.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's beautifully said. I think that he says, I'm a catalyst artist. Like, I make stuff.
I love that. That was great.
And it catalyzes stuff. And I think it's very like savvy on your part to be like, this is yet another like catalyst thing. This may not be a masterpiece in and of itself, but the things that we get downstream from this, the possibilities that it reveals, could really produce some amazing stuff. I completely agree with that. And I also, the other thing you said about a kind of stepping back, I do think there's a conscious thing here of he knows the audience isn't as big for this and he's happy about that. But we're so schooled and like famous people, their goal is to get more famous, and successful people, their goal is to get more successful. And that is true for an awful lot of them. That's the drive that got them there, is the drive that keeps them there. But I think part of this was like, hey, what's a really elegant way for me to reset not just like musical expectations, but like my level of fame, my level of like where am I perceived as an artist? Am I allowed to play like a regular club, or does it have to be Coachella? And trying to like reset all the dials to the human scale that he'd like to be at. And again, that's very cool. And
that's going
to
be sick, where it's like 10 p.m. Coachella, Marshmallow, Stray Kids, Peso Pluma, and Andre playing flute all on stage together. Oh, it's going to be sick, bro.
And I will be nowhere near that amazing bill, but
yeah.
I think it's cool. And I think you also alluded to it. Man, there's a lot of Andre stuff out there. Like, if you want to hear Andre rap, you can hear Andre rap. You can hear Andre rap in 95.
Buy my old albums.
Buy my old albums. I mean, I just respect so much about being like, hey, man, like, you actually don't need more bars. Like, I'm sure there are Andre verses that most people have never heard in their lives. Like, they're out there. Go find them.
Yeah. Like, maybe the Unk Walk It Out remix.
Yeah,
like,
see, I knew we could count on you for that. Yeah. Actually, I've heard that one. Yeah,
that's a really good one. And yeah, maybe, let's listen. Actually, good just one. I hate to do this, but let's listen to a little bit of the Unk Walk It Out remix. Walk it out like a usher. If you say real talk, I probably won't trust you. If you want to go to war, the gun's my pleasure. Even Jesus had 12 disciples on the lever, trigger, whatever. You don't want now, they get 3,000. I'm like jury duty. You're new to this part of town. Your white tee will to me look like a nightgown. Make your mama proud. Take that thing two sides down. Then you look like the man. Okay, here's the last thing I want to ask. And again, it's like, as profile writers, as professional interviewers, like, there is, you mentioned earlier, there is this kind of like blurry line between, we're not a therapist, but we are asking thoughtful, potentially invasive questions to people who are not necessarily inclined to give it up. But something that I felt like I would want to ask, and I wonder if you either asked it or approached the subject matter or could vibe what his answer would be. I think about the literalness of walking through the world carrying an appendage, carrying an instrument, and always being, when you're spotted, like always being filmed with the instrument. To me, that's such a easy / slick way of absolutely anonymizing yourself and taking the heat off of you as a famous person moving through the world. It is an implied barrier. And even the way that he holds, I mean, look, I don't have one of those flutes. I don't know what the right way to hold it is. But just even the holding, it's like you have to get through the flute to get to him. It's here. And I wonder if he talked about actually the physicality of holding / playing the instrument, or what you picked up even just spending the day with him, as he sometimes didn't wield the instrument with his hands.
I think this is like where you just get into some artists are real artists, and there's something deep inside him that was like, you got to carry this flute around and you got to practice it while you're doing your laundry. This is like the difference between like even really successful artists, let alone like the two of us and Andre, is there just a voice that says to him, man, You got to carry this flute around and you got to play it in the TSA pre-line at LAX. And he's just like, all right. And I do think you and I are both sort of students of fame, for lack of a better word. It's like it's something I'm very interested in. And in a very different context, I used to really admire this about Kanye West. I hear there's a book about that coming soon. Is that written yet? How's that coming?
Prayers up for all involved.
Okay, yeah. But before he took it, the turn they took, he used to do really interesting stuff with his fame. He'd just be like, hey, man, we're having a fashion show at Madison Square Garden. They invented going live on Instagram, and I'm live on Instagram from some weird place. And I think in a much more benign, morally acceptable, praiseworthy way, Andre is like, hey, man, I have a lot of money. I have fame. And what I'm going to do with it is wander the earth with a flute. And I don't mean to make him sound like an alien, because I think to him, it actually seems like a really normal thing to do. But that's the thing I love about that man.
The last nomad, like truly the last nomad. Like, and that's why it's very rarely do I say like an album feels like hard to critique. It's like, that's the job. Like I'm a critic. It's like critic, you to critic the work of the critic. But so much of what is crucial about this record truly does not have to do with the particular arrangements of notes. It has to do with the choice to lay those notes down. That is a very different kind of conversation. Anyway, I know you were saying that he is a called artist, and that's, but you know, I woke up today and I was called to podcast with you. So like, this is what I got.
That's right. Literally, I got a text like an hour ago. So that's, I was called 55 minutes ago.
Unexpected times and packages. Thanks to Zach. Before we come back with Sadie, let's listen to a little bit of the last song on this Andre album, which is actually, I think, one of the better songs. And that's Dreams Once Buried Beneath the Dungeon Floor Slowly Sprout Into Undying Gardens. We're back, part two of the Andre Three Stacks flautist cast. As I mentioned in the first segment, there were some challenges that I was having with this record. And there was a review that I read that I felt chastened by, because this is a review that engaged the album on the terms of the scene from which it emerged and embraced it. And in such a thoughtful way that I had to look in the mirror and say, John, what are you doing? Where are you falling off? And so I wanted to bring on the writer of that review to really talk not simply about, is this album good or bad? It's unknowable. But from where is it birthed? And Sadie Sartini Garner is here. Sadie wrote the review for Pitchfork, gave it Best New Music. Big endorsement. Sadie writes Pitchfork, has written for The Ringer and other places. And I'm psyched that you're here. Welcome to Bobcast.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be here. It's a pleasure.
So, as I said, not simply the enthusiasm of the piece that you wrote, but also the kind of patience and empathy in the piece about the overall universe that this album exists in really jumped out at me. Because obviously, one of the signature challenges that many people, potentially myself included, are having is, how do you locate this in an Andre 3000 context? And I thought what your review did really well was to say, maybe that's not the right question. The question might be, don't see this as Andre 3000 as the center of gravity. There's an entire scene and musical universe which he has now relocated himself both physically and spiritually into. So can you talk a little bit about your first, before we get into the sort of Carlos Nino scene and all those musicians, can you talk a little bit about just your first engagement with the record? When you first listened to it, how quickly did you peg it for what it was doing through that lens?
I'm going to do exactly what you said you didn't want to do and say, the moment that I saw that Carlos Nino's name was on this record and that he had a co-production credit alongside Andre, I had a really strong idea of how this album was going to sound. Carlos is a guy who's super involved in the music scene out here in LA, to put it mildly. And he's worked with everybody. We can get into the many people that he's worked with and the ways that he's been a massive influence in LA for the last two decades, really. But I think the question that I had wasn't so much what's this album going to sound like. It was what's Andre going to sound like on this album.
Interesting. I think,
like everybody, I'd seen plenty of videos of him playing the flute in Tokyo, playing the flute in Philly, playing the flute at LAX. And it sounds like unaccompanied flute music when you hear him play it, which is to say it's not wildly appealing for a general audience. And he's learning the instrument, right? He maybe hadn't developed a voice yet. And to be fair, he's playing for himself. He's practicing. So I was curious, how is Andre going to approach this music? Carlos has recorded with very heavy artists who are blowing real hard in the Pharoah Sanders, let's say Pharoah Sanders 1972 vein. And he's recorded with artists who play very softly and beautifully, let's say Pharoah Sanders in a 2020 vein. And so for me, it was, I assumed Andre 3000, big personality, not afraid to take massive risks. A guy, when he's rapping, who instantly commands all the attention on any track he's on, no matter what he's doing. I thought maybe we'd get the first version. And I was really surprised to see how quiet he's playing on this record and how he seems to be not only respectful of his instrument, but respectful of his abilities on that instrument and respectful of the voices and abilities of his bandmates or his ensemble. And that to me was like, I found that for a superstar to come into that setting and do something like that, I found pretty interesting.
Well, I think what I thought in the very much along the lines of what you're describing it and knowing, like having interviewed Andre over the years and knowing what his post Outkast life has looked like, Andre is an artist, a creative person who has been in a ongoing state of retreat, I think, for the better part of 15 years now. And in this scene, I wonder if in its relative anonymity and if it in its established set of players and potentially norms and practices, if he found a safe space where he could almost use the rules or boundaries. And obviously this is an experimental scene, so boundaries is maybe not the right word, but use the practices of this scene as cover to almost hide underneath, not in a scared way, but in a, I don't wish to be the center. So where better to end up than in a scene such as this, which does not appear to privilege people who wish to be in the center.
I think that's very much the case. I think this scene, very loosely speaking, maybe being a bit generous, is also somewhat responsible for Flying Lotus and Kamasi Washington launching into the national imagination, let's say. Kamasi especially, really both of them are still very heavily involved here. I think Kamasi played on a Nate Mercero record, I think maybe within the last month, or maybe it's about to come out, something like that. It's a place that knows how to nurture, let's say, excessive talent. And I think it's a way that maybe it's the LA of it all or whatever, but people don't tend to be weird about it. Matthew David, who plays on the record from Leaving Records, he's for a number of years now, he's done this thing at a park on the East Side called listen to music in daylight under a tree, where it started off very small, like him and maybe an MPC or something like that, and one or two other people. And as it's grown to this kind of outdoor new age ambient music happening over the last several years, he's been able to bring somebody like Flying Lotus to play at this, what's essentially like a free festival almost. Like it's, I don't know, not to be hyperbolic, but it feels like one of the closest things to a kind of late 60s San Francisco Grateful Dead in Golden Gate Park type of vibe. And I think that kind of sense of low-keyness would have to be super appealing to somebody like Andre, who obviously loves music, is engaged with music, and is deeply engaged with the artists who are the major touchstones for a lot of the artists who are working in that world already.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit about Carlos. My earliest engagements with Carlos was actually not as a musician, but as a writer, if I'm not mistaken. Carlos used to write for a magazine, I hope I'm not screwing this up, but Herb Magazine, which was very big in Los Angeles in the 90s and into the 2000s, which I used to freelance for 155 years ago. Carlos was a writer for Herb. That's the first time I encountered his name. And then I remember he started putting out records on maybe it was Ubiquity Records. I'm trying to remember. There were definitely a couple of LA labels where he was putting out. How can you even describe them? Like, they, I don't think they didn't feel at the time fully experimental, like the more recent records with his name on them that I've heard. They maybe were a little bit dubby, jazzy, like instrumental hip hop. They were sort of like pulling some texture from hip hop production, but then moving in more abstract directions, if memory serves. And then I didn't know very much about what he was doing into the late 2000s and 2010s until I encountered this sort of series of records that he's been working on. Can you talk about those things and the what's been building up around him?
If you spend any time in the LA sort of jazz underground or kind of soft experimental music underground, there are two names that you will encounter basically anytime you go to a show, and that's Carlos Nino and Miguel Atwood Ferguson. They are both guys who are just involved with, I mean, basically every kind of, if it's a jazz thing, if it's a new age thing, if it's a ambient thing, they're both guys who know everybody in the scene. They've played with everybody. They have a lot of goodwill among people because they're both very generous with their time, their knowledge, and they're great at connecting people, which is difficult to do in LA. You know, it's a notoriously difficult to make friends and develop community out here. And they are people, and Carlos in particular, people who are, for whom that's very important. And I think it's instructive that these records he's done recently, he puts out under the name Carlos Nino and Friends rather than Carlos Nino Group or just under his own name, because that sense of doing something with your friends, making a project with your friends who all just happen to be like wildly talented, wildly creative musicians is very central to what he's doing. I think the first time I saw him live, he was playing percussion with Dexter Story, who is a sort of, I think in the Pitchfork review, I called him like fluid Ethio funk, but he's basically doing an update on Ethiopian music from the 70s, a very like heavy Malatu Estake type of influence. And Carlos was one of his percussionists that night, alongside a guy named Ronnie De Leon, who's like triggering noise samples and shit like that. It was a very cool take on that kind of music. Carlos with an absolute battery of percussion instruments. And it was very clear to me watching him that night at Zebulon that he is responding in real time to Dexter's compositions. Dexter's got a set song. Carlos is doing what he feels the song needs in the moment. So he might shake his shells for a second, and then he might instantly throw them down and hit a gong. And he might go from there to like a jaw rattle or something like that. And while that can look a little chaotic and feel a little strange, I think it's indicative of the way that he is almost preternaturally attuned to the people that he's making music with.
To the degree that there is a center of gravity, even in this sort of fundamentally centralist scene, Carlos is from what you're saying. And I wonder the types of music that has spilled out over into, because you mentioned Kamasi earlier, and obviously one of the reasons that a lot of people came to the work of Kamasi and that whole scene is because of Kendrick. That music starts to move out into the broader pop or hip hop worlds. Are there other better known or more public facing folks who have worked with this scene of musicians?
It's certainly possible that there have been some bigger names. I'm not going to claim that I'm an expert in Carlos's oof by any means, not to use a word we all love, but I think he's worked pretty frequently with a couple of guys who are in the world of new age music, or broadly speaking, ambient music, are pretty widely beloved. And that's both Iyasos, the new age musician, and Laraji, the extremely delightful player of the zither and for whom laughter is a literal instrument. Laraji, if you've ever, anybody has a chance to see Laraji, you should just see Laraji.
Go do it.
Even if you don't enjoy the music, like it's just a wonderful time. It's beautiful to see somebody just smile and laugh and make music that hangs in the air. It's a nice feeling. So he'd worked quite frequently with both of them.
So I was struck because obviously Laraji is a touch point, a touchstone for some of the stuff that we're hearing on the Sandre record, I think. Alice Definitely. Coltrane. But I will say, like, where I find both of those artists in their own ways These are different ways. I find them soothing and engulfing in certain ways, even though the way that they achieve that musically is to me very different. I didn't feel that on this record. If anything, this record gave me anxiety because I felt like it was not as successful or polished or knowing as the music made by those folks. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what did you hear Andre doing on this record as a musician, and how, in your experience, did it successfully and maybe not successfully in places interplay with everything else that's happening on the songs?
One of the major differences between what's happening on New Blue Sun and what happens on a Laraji record, or perhaps to a lesser extent an Alice Coltrane record, is there is a lot of chop in this album. If you just have it on your laptop speakers and are not paying attention to it, it's an album that will just slide through you pretty easily. But the closer the attention you pay to it, the more difficult it becomes in some ways. And a lot of that is owing to Carlos's production method. A lot of it is he's working in a kind of, I think of him almost as somebody working in a diorama or something like that. For him, a record is a spherical, three-dimensional space. And he's very conscious of where you're hearing certain things. And he's also very, very good at frustrating your expectations of where you're going to hear certain things. So I always think of it as like a series of rooms that he wants to bring you through, and he wants to tease you with a sound coming from another room. This is a really abstract way of talking about sound design, essentially, but it is an interesting way to approach music that is nominally healing or nominally comforting, I should say, in a way that makes it, for me personally, more artful and more interesting. So when listening to New Blue Sun, the closer I listen to it, the more I'm hearing these kind of layers upon layers. And what makes it fascinating for me as regards Andre is that I don't feel as though he's doing anything more than anyone else. Like, I wouldn't call him the lead artist on this record by any means. I think it's got his name on the sleeve because he's the one who wanted to make the record, I think. He's played on Carlos's records in the past, so there's no... I don't think it's an egocentrism thing. I don't think it's like, I'm the guy in the studio who's the most famous, so let's roll with it. I think it's genuinely, he said, I want to make this project, but it does feel like a Carlos Nino and Andre and Friends kind of record to me sometimes.
It's worth underscoring that point, which is obviously Andre's name is on the record, but I do not believe that the experience of this music is Andre-led music.
No.
It is Andre-participated music, but maybe not Andre-led music.
Yeah, not to use language that is going to make me sound more Californian than I probably already do, but I would say it's like spirit-led music. It's free improv. So you're going in with no idea. You don't really know what you're going to do. And you're just going where the song takes you. And you can have a dominant personality in this kind of music that leads the way, that kind of pulls things forward, that sets the tone. You might think of maybe, this isn't a perfect example, but the way Ornette Coleman leads the double quartet in the free jazz record, you can have a sort of dominant personality, but this music is really all about the spontaneous generation of a vibe, man. It's just all about, it's about creating a vibe. And that sounds silly, and I get that.
No, but I think it's helpful because I do think so many people who have never encountered a record like this are going to encounter this record.
Yeah, that's so true.
And I think providing some kind of grammar to those folks is useful. And even if you come out not liking it, it's still useful to have the grammar of the terms of which it was created. I think that's still like a useful thing to offer.
Something that I personally find very meaningful about this kind of music is that I think it really upsets the way I've always been taught to think about musical priorities. When you grow up listening to pop songs and rock and roll songs or whatever, you grow up with an innate understanding of form. Verse, chorus, verse, bridge, whatever. And you need a strong melody, you need a driving rhythm, or you need at least an interesting rhythm. And this music has no interest in any of that. There's no beginning or end. It's, if you like, it's all middle. Sometimes there can be peaks and valleys, but primarily it's about a mode of exploration. I was just talking with a good friend of mine about the writer W.G. Sable, who he did these wonderful books where he's just walking through the Suffolk coast in England and commenting on what he sees. There's no real plot. They don't really go anywhere. It's just Sebald walking down the road or walking down the beach or whatever. And in a real way, this record and records from this world are very much like that. It's an experience that you witness more so than participate in as a listener. And that can be really challenging for people. And I include myself in that because there are many times like I was stuck in traffic driving to LAX today, famously busy 405 traffic weekend of Thanksgiving or whatever. And it was awful. Like, I can't be listening to New Blue Sun in that situation. You know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong. I tried.
Yeah, but it didn't work. Also, that's definitely the first W.G. Sable reference in podcast history, I'm pretty sure. So,
you know what? I'm happy to be expanding the horizons here.
Absolutely.
Shout out W.G. Sable. Shout out Rings of Saturn.
Shout out a real one. Here's a question. And I think this has come up a few times over the years on jazz focused episodes of the show, and especially about jazz musicians better known for improv as opposed to songwriting. Gio Ruscinello writes about jazz for us, Nate Chenin before Gio. Something that has come up from time to time is like, hey, if that's a thing that the musician excels at, is a recording the right place to meet that musician? Is a recording even an appropriate choice if really the thing that is excelled at is something that happens in a live, tactile space? I mean, I even think of this about the great freestyle rappers of the late 90s, like a Supernatural or somebody, where if you've ever listened to a Supernatural freestyle, you're like, that's unreal. I can't believe a person could do that. And then you listen to 12 Inch that he put out and you're like, bro, this is bad. This is just like legit no good. It's not neutral. It's bad. And so this record seems to bring up similar questions, which is everything you're talking about. There's like a practice of engagement of there's a vibe. Before we started recording, you were like, it's a gestalt. And yeah, it is a effing gestalt. You ain't wrong. You know what I mean? But is a recording appropriate? Like when I wrote about, like, I didn't write about the album as a full piece, but we put a song in our Friday playlist and I wrote about it and I was like, it's a lot of middles. There's no beginning. There's no end. It's a lot of middle and various.
I knew
middles.
I bit that middle thing from somebody. I didn't realize I was biting it from you.
It's totally fine. So to me, it's a philosophical question. And I wonder, as someone steeped in the scene, I wonder how you think about that philosophically.
The writer John Corbett would say, he wrote the book, Listener's Guide to Free Improvisation, which is a fantastic book. And if you are remotely curious by this music, if this record makes you want to know more about how to understand this kind of music, I cannot recommend John Corbett's Listener's Guide to Free Improvisation enough. It's incredibly plain language, very easy to understand, but beautiful introduction into how to understand spontaneously created music. He would say, like, there's no point in a record because the whole thing needs to be witnessed live as it's happening. I got stuff to do. I can't be going to Zebulon every Thursday night to see everybody jam. And so for me, having a record is a lovely thing. And I think in the case of this specific record and the way that Carlos Nino approaches music generally, I think this is a little bit different from that because while the music that you hear is being spontaneously generated, it is the product of free improv. Carlos is still going back and working with it as a producer, and an Andre as well in this case, because they did it together. In the same way that like Miles Davis with In a Silent Way is like taking this long, 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 long jam and reshaping it, turning it into a more or less coherent piece of music. Like Carlos is essentially doing the same thing, taking these pieces of music that started these long spontaneous jams. He's putting them in his computer or however he does it. And him and Andre are shaping it into a new object together. So it is fundamentally different from a piece of free improv. It's not, you couldn't hear this music played live in this way. And when they do play this stuff together live, which they've said they're going to do, I think, it's not going to sound like the record. It's going to be a very different experience because all that sort of chopping and the layering and the sort of beautiful 3D effects that they put into this record are not, there's just not really a way to recreate that live. I don't know, unless you get that weird thing Johnny Greenwood has for you, like, pull in a sample. I don't know. I don't really know much about Radiohead.
You and me both. You and me both. This is a Radiohead free podcast, to be candid.
Yeah. Okay, great. I feel even safer.
No, this is not. This is, I mean, now I'm going to get a bunch of emails complaining that I don't like. There's always going to be some emails, but look, this podcast has survived insulting the Beatles. It could probably survive insulting Radiohead. It's fine. Let me ask one last framing question that I think people want to know the answer to, and I'm curious to hear your specific answer to. In the GQ interview, Andre says, at least when it comes to the digital wind instrument, he's playing a few different wind instruments throughout this album, but at least in regards to the digital wind instrument, he starts playing, they're recording him 20 minutes after he's unpacked it and he's playing for the first time. And he says, I can hear myself like I'm a baby, like taking first steps. Now, candidly, if I picked up the same instrument, I would not, and started recording 20 minutes after I started playing it, I wouldn't share that with people personally. I wouldn't. And obviously, I am not a great American musician. Andre is a great American musician. Like, yeah, I'm willing to concede that. But I wonder if you could talk to the degree that you could isolate his contributions. What do you make of Andre as an actual musician and as a technician in this context?
I'm glad you separated that from musician.
Yeah, they're different. They're definitely different.
Exactly. They're definitely different. Andre is not a, I'm gonna say something risky. No. He's not a virtuoso on this instrument.
That's not risky. That's not a risky player. That's not risky. That's generous.
I was underplaying it. Andre is not. I mean, he's like you said, a baby can barely do anything, right? He clearly is learning the instrument on the fly. And to me, that actually, I mean, I read that and I was like, I want to hear that more than I want to hear the handmade flute thing. I want to hear somebody whose music has meant so much to me, who I think is a technical genius, because when it comes to rapping, I mean, his technical skills as a rapper simply can't be topped, right? They're extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's amazing. And so to see him put himself in a position where he's almost destined to fail. He is not going to do on the flute what he does on International Players Anthem. It's just not possible. I want to hear, how does Andre 3000 express himself when he doesn't have the means to do? What does that sound like? And that's a fascinating thing. And I think what you hear in the course of the record, and I think the first track, I'm not going to say the whole thing.
Just call it number one. Know, yeah.
Yeah. Track. That's how I did it in my notes. When it's track one, you hear him play this kind of like dotted melody that's four or five notes with a little long note at the end. It's incredibly beautiful. It's rudimentary. And you can hear a kind of lack of confidence in what he's doing. He's obviously trying out the boundaries of this melody to see, does this work in the context of this music? And obviously, your answer is going to be different from mine, is going to be different from the next person's. But for me personally, that sort of quavering vulnerability coming from the mouth of somebody who I have heard do things I've never heard anybody else do is quite touching, to be honest. And for me, it just makes it very compelling. All that being said, he's not Eric Dolphy.
Yeah.
He's not up there.
No.
But he doesn't, but I think for me, he doesn't have to be. Like, the music doesn't demand that of him in the same way that I Want to Be Sedated didn't require Jimi Hendrix to play guitar in it or whatever. He's there to do what the music needs of him. And he reaches that bar for me. Again, this is all highly subjective,
as
I am wildly aware. But for me, it works really well when I can hear those vulnerabilities. And honestly, when I hear him blending into the ensemble, because this is all, again, it's like a gestalt. Like, it's, you want to hear the whole overall picture more so than the individual performances. And in that way, like, it was framed as a jazz record. It's not a jazz record at all. There's no reason to think of it as a jazz record. And I think that maybe set up an expectation for what his playing would be like.
That's a good point. Good point. Yeah, yeah. Also, I'm glad you mentioned the Ramones, because it's important to remember, and I say this as a person that did not enjoy this album, or was at minimum skeptical of it. There's moments of it that are I liked, but I'm skeptical of it. But it is important, as critics and as listeners, think of all the music that we like in other genres with people singing, rapping, playing whatever their instrument is in either a deliberately naive style or in a not that refined style. But we welcome it because something about that creates an effect that maybe technical mastery glides right past. So it's important, I think, to know that to make that case that it's not simply Andre plays well versus Andre doesn't play well, which means it's good versus it's bad. That's not what we're talking about here. But I do think it's interesting to try to break down this album specifically into the component parts and say, what do we know about Andre as a musician? What do we know about Andre as a gestalt guy? What do we know about each of these things? And then that helps hopefully enhance the listening experience with illuminates it, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that's getting back to what I was saying earlier about how this kind of music can fundamentally upset your priorities when it comes to listening to music and then upset your values as well. Because like you said, it's not, for me, this is maybe not something I should say as somebody who does write for a famously ranking website, right. But I don't particularly care. I don't particularly care to rank music. I don't think that it makes a lot of sense to say that this Andre record is better or worse than much of anything else, because they're all discrete experiences to me. And I can say I enjoy certain things more than others, but I don't know. Like I've got friends who love the Black Crowes. You know what I mean?
Sadie, we can't help everybody.
I got my feeling on the Black Crowes, obviously, but you know, the way they feel the same way about that stuff that I feel watching something uncontroversial like John Mayer playing with the Grateful Dead.
Wow. Talk about healing.
Indeed. Anyway, to me, it's become so important to hold on to the subjectivity of everything that we do as critics, because at the end of the day, my role isn't to tell you like this music is good or this music is bad. My role is to say, here's where this music is coming from, and let me open one path for you into the music. And hopefully you open your own path into it as well. I recognize that's probably why I'm the person writing about the Andre 3000 New Age record.
Yeah, but you know what? That's before I go out, I want to say my mom listened to a lot of Andreas Vollerinder in the 80s. I definitely, the Pure Moods compilation, I definitely fuck with that heavy. Not averse to music of this kind. But the reason I wanted you on was specifically to open this neural and oral, A-U-R-A-L, pathway for people to potentially find a way into this record, regardless of what they ended up taking away from it. So I'm grateful that you're here. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. I appreciate it.
That is our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Listen and watch Podcast Deluxe. That's me and Joe on YouTube at youtube.com/podcast. Subscribe at YouTube. We have our own channel now. Subscribe to the podcast in general, anywhere you get your audio content. That's Spotify, Apple, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook. That's tinyurl.com/podcastdiscord or /podcastfacebook. And email us any questions, podcast@nytimes.com. Perhaps if you are doing a Andre 3000 New Age album song title generator type thing, send me some things that maybe could be Andre 3000 song titles. Thanks to Zach Barron and Sadie Sartini Garner for being on the show this week. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Head Separate Media. Let's go out with something from the Andre record, and that is "That Night in Hawaii When I Turned Into a Panther and Started Making These Low Register Purring Tones That I Couldn't Control. Shit Was Wild."